Hi, my name is Jackie Johnson, and I'm the receptionist and special projects person here at Family Talk. And I just wanted to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Christmas edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, along with your host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And Dr. Dobson, throughout this month, we're going to be airing the best programs from this past year, 2014, and today we're going to hear the second part of one of those great programs.
One of the very best, Dr. Meeker. A few months ago, yes, we had the great privilege of interviewing Dr. Ben Carson about many of the issues related to our country, and especially about his own childhood and upbringing. He's such a smart man, and I really enjoyed his perspective on many problems that we're experiencing in today's culture. Specifically, I really enjoyed Dr. Carson's take on political correctness. Boy, he has some strong opinions about that.
Yes.
He often refers to them as the PC police. PC is a dangerous problem in our culture, and he knows it. And I'm glad that he hasn't let it get in the way of him speaking out on what he truly believes. As I mentioned last time, we do want to make it clear to our audience that as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, Family Talk cannot endorse a political candidate. And that is not what we're doing today. First of all, because as far as I know, Dr. Carson has not made the decision to run for president of the United States. And even if he did, we would not be able to endorse him for the reasons that I indicated. But we're going to be hearing a recording that was made several months ago with Dr. Carson in our studio, and we were talking about his book, One Nation, which was heard here on Family Talk this past summer.
Yes. Well, Doctor, let me remind our audience about who Dr. Ben Carson is. He's just recently retired as the Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins after 35 years of service. During his tenure at the hospital, he became the first neurosurgeon in history to successfully separate conjoined twins joined at the head. He is also the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor in the United States, and that was given to him by President George W. Bush. And as I mentioned last time, you and I could fill an entire program with Dr. Carson's credentials. They're extraordinary. He's an extraordinary man. But we need to stop so we can actually enjoy today's broadcast.
Thank you, Dr. Meeker. Let's get on with the program now. Here's our interview with Dr. Ben Carson for the second part of One Nation on today's Best Of edition of Family Talk. Describe your relationship with Christ today. Does he continue to walk with you? Has he led you to leave the university, leave academia, and all the whole medical community, and to do what you're doing now? And if so, why do you think so?
I would feel extremely vulnerable if I didn't feel that he was right here by my side. Every moment, every step of the way. It was that way throughout my medical career. You know, if you had set me in front of a computer and said, type out the career you want to have, I could not have come up with the kind of career that he gave me. No possibility. And the kind of cases, you know, the separation of the Bender twins, they were joined at the back of the head, something we saw, occipital craniopagus. Those kind had never
that
before.
Had never been done.
Been
before.
Done and survived. The people that he put in my life to help with that, the fact that he actually inspired me to get interested in that. Because 2 months before I knew anything about them, I had this insatiable appetite to find out about craniopagus twins and read all the literature, talked to people, trying to figure out why the results were so dismal, and came to the conclusion that it was just exsanguination or bleeding to death. And then talking to a friend of mine, the chief of cardiothoracic surgery at Johns Hopkins, I said, what do you do when you operate on a baby's heart? how do you keep them from bleeding out? And he explained to me the whole process of hypothermic arrest. And I started thinking, wow, if you could incorporate that into some of the sophisticated techniques we have for brain surgery, I bet this could be done. And then I said, why am I thinking about this? I'm never going to see a set of those twins. Lo and behold, 2 months later, here came the German doctors presenting the case at various medical centers around the world because the mother wouldn't accept what they offered in Europe, which is she had to decide which twin she wanted to keep, and the other one would be cut off. And when I explained, you know, this whole process,
everybody got excited. So it was assumed that one was going to die.
Yes. And, you know, fortunately, at a place like Hopkins, you have a lot of top-notch specialists in every area. And we put together a team, started talking about this ideal, and 5 months later, we did the operation.
And it was a huge success, and
but that
your
was,
name
that was the
went
Lord.
All over the medical community, and yes, a lot of laymen know about it.
That was the Lord leading. And then he led me in so many different areas, you know, the hemispherectomies, where we take out half of a child's brain to stop intractable seizures, with achondroplasty, cervical medullary decompressions to decompress their brain stems. You know, there was a lot of anger directed at me when I proposed a new way of doing that because the old ways, so many people died. And, you know, they even brought me up before the AMA before I was able to reveal the data, which demonstrated that not a single one of the patients had died and they all were doing well. And now that's an accepted technique. You know, when I did first intrauterine surgery on a hydrocephalic twin, a lot of criticism. It's unethical. We're not ready to do that. Until it became clear that not only the normal twin, but the hydrocephalic one was doing well, too. Then people said, well, I would have done that, too, under those circumstances. But, you know, there was a lot of controversy throughout my career. And things worked out. And I knew that that was the good Lord leading. And just like now, there's controversy. But I think in the long run, people will see what I'm talking about. People will understand that the way that you help the poor and the downtrodden is not by patting them on the head and saying, there, there, you poor little thing. The way you do it is you provide them with a ladder, with a mechanism to climb up and to realize, you know, the American dream.
You know, I've watched you from a distance for a long time. And what has moved me emotionally and what I've appreciated so much is that you're not just a man with a lot of knowledge, a lot of medical knowledge, a lot of technical skill, but you're a strong man. You're a man of great conviction. You know what you believe, and you're not afraid to stand up for it. Mm-hmm. And God has given you a lot of wisdom beyond your medical expertise.
He has, and I pray for it constantly, for wisdom. And I'll tell you something about the good Lord that I found out. He has a sense of humor because, you know, since the day of that stabbing attempt, I've started and ended every day reading from the book of Proverbs.
Really?
Which, of course, was written by Solomon. Now, he had my parents give me that middle name at birth, Solomon. Yeah. When he became the king of Israel, do you remember the first thing he did that brought him great acclaim? Two women claim to be the mother of the same baby.
Yes.
What did he advocate? Divide the babies. Well, that's when I became very well known, when I divided babies.
Isn't that interesting?
I think he has a sense of humor.
So the Lord answers those kinds of
He does. And he's a master of irony. Here I was trying to kill somebody with a knife, and he gives me a career with a knife.
My goodness. Do you miss medicine today?
I certainly miss the way it used to be. I don't miss what it was becoming.
How has it changed?
It has changed dramatically with so many rules and regulations and oversights. And that's why I've been working hard with members of Congress, with other physicians, people to come up with a real alternative. I want medicine to be fun again. I want people, you know, to look forward to going to work and using the talent that God has given them to save people. People didn't sign up to work for the government when they went to medical school. And we can do so much better than this. And also, I say this from the perspective of someone who has read a lot of material, including the works of Saul Alinsky, who talks about the eight principles of changing over a society. And the number one thing he says is you must gain control of healthcare, because that's how you make people dependent. So, you know, we see the results of that mentality. It's so clear right now. This is the good thing about it. It's so clear the choice that Americans have to make. Do they want to continue along the course of government expansion, government intervention, government control, and basically government replacement of God as the moral authority in your life? Is that what we want? Or do we want to go back to a country that is for of and by the people and that has solid Judeo-Christian values, recognizing that it was those values and principles that took us from nowhere to the pinnacle of the world in record time, much faster than anybody else ever got there, and to a much higher pinnacle than anybody else ever reached? Are we ready to throw that away for the so-called utopian society, which always ends up looking the same way, with a small group of elites at the top who control everything and have all the money, a rapidly vanishing middle class, and a rapidly expanding dependent class? Is that what we really want?
In fact, you discussed that in your book, One Nation, What We Can Do to Save America's Future.
Absolutely.
Does it really come down to that? Can we save America's future? Let me ask it another way. You're speaking all over the country, and I mean literally all over the country.
Yes.
And I want to ask you in a minute or two about a speech you gave at the Presidential Prayer Breakfast in 2013. But you're talking to thousands of people. They're coming in hordes to listen to you. It's jammed everywhere you go.
Yes.
And the reason is because they see something in you and they hear something that they long for. Is there hope for America? Can we save this great nation?
There is hope. What happened is that the people have been beaten down. They have been beaten into submission. Rule number one in Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals, you make the majority believe that what they think is no longer rational, and nobody thinks that way, and that what you think is the only way that intelligent people think. If you can co-opt the media in the process, you're far ahead in that game. That's why it has occurred so rapidly. And, you know, basically when they hear someone like myself or like Senator Cruz or people who aren't afraid of the media, who aren't afraid of the PC police, it gives them a spark of hope. And what I'm telling people is you have to become a part of this army. First of all, you are the majority. Do not let the vocal minority bully you into believing that your thoughts, your beliefs, your values, and your principles are no longer valid. And then I need you to go out and spread that message in your sphere of influence. And if we can get
people to do that. That's what you're out there doing, isn't
it? Absolutely. We get enough people to do that, we change our nation in the right direction. And I am absolutely convinced that that's going to happen. And when we, in fact, have control. And when I'm talking about we, I'm talking about people with common sense. Yeah. I don't care what party they belong to. People with common sense. What we have to do is understand that we have an obligation to put the Constitution of the United States back on the top shelf. I think it was an inspired document. And we have an obligation to ensure all the freedoms that were guaranteed in it.
It's being undermined every day.
Absolutely. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of press, all of these things are essential to our way of life. We cannot allow them to be gradually eroded by those who have the desire to fundamentally change our nation.
I mentioned earlier the speech you gave at the Presidential Prayer Breakfast in 2013. President Obama and Michelle Obama were sitting there to your right, I think. And on the other side was Vice President Biden. And what you were saying was very offensive to them, or at least it contradicted just about everything that they have stood for. You stood up there in front of 3,000 people, because I've been to that prayer breakfast many times, and you stood there and said things that were, you talk about not being PC, politically correct. They were the opposite of that. And you didn't flinch. Where'd you get the guts to do that in front of the most powerful man in the United States and in the world?
It came from the good Lord. I didn't know what I was going to say. I knew the Lord wanted me to say something.
Specific,
because when I got the invitation, my first question was, Lord, what are you up to? Because I had spoken there 17 years earlier, and I didn't know that anybody ever did it twice. And then I found out that Billy Graham has done it twice. And I knew I had some big shoes to fill. And I said, Lord, you obviously want me to say something. I don't know what
you,
it is.
You spoke in 1997 when Bill Clinton was president.
Correct.
And that was the Monica Lewinsky
yes.
era. You spoke there.
I did.
You waded into it.
And I talked about integrity in office. And he must have been saying, does he know? But anyway, he was very gracious. But at any rate, I didn't know what I was going to say until the morning of the prayer breakfast. And when I awakened that morning, I had a sense of calm, of peace. I knew exactly what I was going to say. And when I got up there and I started talking, I was totally oblivious to who was to my right or who was to my left. I was talking to the American people, and I was in a zone. Sometimes when I look back at it, and I just say, is that me talking? But I always ask the Lord, I don't care which group I'm talking to, what am I supposed to say? How am I supposed to reach people? And he always gives me the right things to say.
Well, he certainly did on that occasion. I'm not positive of this, but I've heard that the White House was very critical of what you said that day.
Well, I got a call about 15 minutes afterwards saying that the White House was very upset that I needed to call the president immediately and apologize. And I said, well,
who would that have been?
The organizers of the prayer breakfast. And I just said, I spoke to the president afterwards. He seemed quite cordial. And unless the things that I said applied to him, I don't see why he would be upset.
That's a Jesus-like answer. My goodness. And then the media was all over you.
They were. And the liberal media started scrutinizing every word that I said, every phrase, anything, trying to find some way to discredit me, because they needed to get me out of there quickly, because they realized that I was a terrible threat to all the things that they represented. So they poured on everything.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Calling me all kinds of names, saying that I was crazy, you know, you name it, they were saying it.
I mean, how can they say that to one of the most well-known physicians, neurosurgeons in the world?
It doesn't matter to them because, you know, it's sort of like when you spray a hornet's nest with Raid. They all come out. They're ready to get you. But what they've been finding out is that the more they attack me, the more popular I become. And I think they're actually starting to realize that now.
But you never heard from the president?
I never heard anything from him. I mean, he did invite me, along with all the other presidential medal winners, to a special occasion, because I think it was like the 50th anniversary of the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Take me back to that.
Well, I didn't go.
That was that was George W. Bush who gave you that award. That's the highest award that a civilian can be given in the United States.
Yeah.
And you got it.
When I first was called about it, I was actually in Indianapolis. We were doing something with our scholarship program with the Indianapolis Colts. And I got the phone call, and they said, you know, congratulations, the Presidential Medal. I said, this is Ben Carson. Who are you looking for? And they said, no, you're the one we want. I said, you're sure about this now? It was an incredible ceremony, just the pomp and circumstances you wouldn't believe. And just a beautiful, beautiful ceremony.
You know the scripture that comes to me? Those who honor me, I will honor.
Absolutely. And that's
you have honored the Lord. You have not changed your theology or your views on the sanctity of human life.
That's correct.
Or on traditional marriage or righteousness in the public square. I haven't heard you change on any of those things.
No, and I'm not likely to change on them because they're God's rules. They're not my rules.
Yeah.
And he doesn't change. So as long as I'm sticking with him, it's going to be hard for me to change. You know, I find it difficult to understand sometimes why ministers are willing to abandon the scripture.
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
I just find that very puzzling.
I do too, especially on the issue of gay marriage.
Yeah.
There are many, many formerly conservative, big-time ministers, I mean those that have large churches and great influence, who have abandoned that.
They've been beaten into submission.
If they're right to do this today, were they wrong yesterday?
Right. Well, you know, the bigger issue is, of course, if you can say the Bible is wrong on that, then, you know, why isn't it wrong on everything or anything that you don't want it to say?
I have been on a crusade to say to many ministers, I'll say it again now, that if men can marry and if the things that are said about same-sex relationships and marriage in the Bible are misunderstandings, what do you do with the rest of LGBT? What do you do with bisexuality?
Right.
If one of those is right and proper and holy, what about those who have sex with males and females at the same time? That's called orgies. That's what it used to be called. Or just sleeping around with everybody, and it doesn't matter. I mean, how can a Christian minister reads the Bible condone that?
Yeah. Well, you know, what my emphasis is that marriage is an institution established by God himself. And when you look in the New Testament, you see that the marriage relationship is used to help us understand his relationship with his people.
That's right.
So
it's
when you start distorting that, I mean, you're really going pretty deep into the finger and your eye to God. So that's why I have a hard time understanding why ministers are willing to do it. I can see why other people wouldn't. But, you know, here's the thing. I don't deny any two consenting adults to do anything they want to do. I'm not going to force them to do anything. But they don't get to change the definition of marriage. Yeah. That is the key. Nobody gets to change it. I don't care who they are. And that's been my point.
Know, I've taken the same position that there's so many things that are on the homosexual agenda that people accuse us of, like being hateful and of trying to force something to. I don't think any of us are trying to do that. People, they're sinful people everywhere doing every form of sin. And we're not out to force them to do anything.
They can do what they want to do.
But you got to deal with the scripture and what it says.
Right. It's when you try to change things for everybody else and make them conform to your idea, which is completely against the traditions of mankind. And when you look at it from a biological point of view, why is there male and female? Obviously, there was a reason that they were made different and a reason that they form a union. So you can take that and you can distort it and you can do whatever you want to it, but it is not marriage. It is something else. And I'm not going to deny you from having it. You can do whatever you want. But why do you have to change it for me? You know, I say it's like a new set of mathematicians, they come along, they say 2 + 2 = 5. And the traditionalists say, no, it's 4. It's always been 4. And the new ones say, no, we insist that it's 5. So the traditionalists say, okay, for you it can be 5, but we're keeping it as 4. And the new ones come back and say, no, it has to be 5 for you too. And if it's not 5 for you, you're a mathist. You know, I mean, this is basically what they're doing. And you know, it doesn't make any sense. They're so intolerant. And I've asked one of the leaders in the homosexual community, I said, look, I don't care what you do, but tell me this. I said, is there any position that someone who believes in traditional marriage between one man and one woman can take that would be satisfactory to you that doesn't embrace gay marriage? And after thinking about it for a while, I said, no. There is no other way. It's my way or the highway.
Well, I hate to cut into this top broadcast of the year, but once again, we're out of time for today. We've been listening to the second part of One Nation here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and if you would like more information about Dr. Carson or his book, One Nation, please visit our website, drjamesdobson.org, or call us at 877-732-6825. This is Dr. Meg Meeker saying Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you again next time, right here, for the conclusion of One Nation, right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.